Christina's dead, Laura. Christina is dead.
Of course. I know, but you know the two ladies in the restaurant? Well, they were watching us while we were eating. They kept staring, so they told me this, because they could see sitting between us. They could see Christine sitting between us.
You're so sad, and there's no need to be.
My sister's psychic.
John just suddenly got up and rushed down to the pond. Almost as if he knew something was going to...
I know this place. What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me?
John.
Is it because of my daughter?
That house is not fit to live in.
What was this room?
We have coming here many mediums and spiritualists and so.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
We are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
We all have someone we miss, loved ones we've lost. It's the inevitability of life that you will encounter death. And we have to live with that. Some of us find comfort and faith in the idea of an afterlife. Others were left with mementos, memories. So it serves that if there was a way, some means to communicate with those we've lost, we might hear it out. Going back to the 1800s, spiritualists believed in the possibility of communication with spirits of the dead, whom they regarded as discarnate humans, thinking that the afterlife is not a static state, but one in which spirits evolve, where they're capable of growth and perfection, progressing through higher planes. Now, according to spiritualists, anyone can receive messages, but formal seances are held by mediums. Spirit mediums, or spirit guides, are those who would carry on such communication. As far back as the 1730s, Emanuel Swedenborg, a visionary Lutheran scientist, claimed in his moment of, quote, spiritual awakening, he received the revelation that he was appointed by Jesus Christ to write the heavenly doctrine to reform Christianity. According to that doctrine, God had opened his spiritual eyes so from then on he could freely visit heaven and hell and talk with angels, demons, and other spirits. Swedenborg was prolific. He wrote journals and papers theorizing how matter relates to spirit. What was very personal to Swedenborg was then made very public by a German physician named Franz Mesmer. Introducing techniques later known as hypnotism or mesmerism, Mesmer claimed to introduce trances and cause subjects to report contact with supernatural beings. These demonstrations grew into public spectacles with professional showmanship, all meant to entertain audiences. In the United States, Andrew Jackson Davis, a practicing mesmerist, faith healer, and clairvoyant from Poughkeepsie, New York, combined Swedenborg and Mesmer's methods into a system he termed harmonial philosophy. In 1847, he published The Principles of Nature, Her Divine Revelations, and A Voice to Mankind. A book he dictated to a friend while in a trance state. The next year, also in New York, the country would first hear of the Fox Sisters, who Mindy will discuss in a little. Now, the history of spiritualism and the players involved is a fascinating one, and we'll go further in depth next episode, but we wanted to start here, at the beginning of a movement who, if we are to believe their mandate, meant to join the living with the dead. So as it relates to the material, I'm a little conflicted because any side that's calling bullshit very quickly comes off as like insensitive to someone having to or wanting to deal with like a lost loved one.
Right.
And I can appreciate that. I've lost a lot of family. There's plenty of people I'd love to speak to.
Right.
I don't think it's going to happen. But at the same time, like, who am I to question someone else's comfort that they're finding in speaking to a medium, whether it's the Long Island medium or John Edwards or there's a long list. James Van Prague, Sylvia Brown.
Stuff like that is totally bullshit, but I don't know. Like, there's a part of me who wants to believe. There's a part of me, though, that would hate to be like, grandma's just like hanging around and can't do shit but watch me all day long. Like, that's like terrible. But there's a part of me that thinks that, like, you know, maybe there is like an alternate like wavelength or something like that.
That's one of the reasons I'm drawn to this subject matter is because it does sort of pretend to inject science into belief.
Right.
And, you know, I like the X-Files poster says, like, I want to believe.
But you don't. You're like Scully and I'm like Mulder and I'm awesome and you're kind of a butthole.
But yeah, I don't know. I am skeptical. I'm not necessarily predisposed to cynicism and just doubting everything and wanting to shit on it. Like, I'm open-minded, but I also think the bar for proof is pretty high and nobody really meets
that. You would think in this modern age where there's phones and everything, you can record anything at any given moment, you would think there would be some sort of proof of it, but I don't know. I'd love to believe that this would be possible. I think there's people who maybe not like in the case of red lights, like not like mind reading kind of stuff, but I think there's people who are incredibly empathetic who can pick up on people's what they're thinking in that way.
Sure. Yeah. And I think it's funny. It's a very modern term, but like micro expressions is something that gets studied now. But the truth is, like, excellent liars and even gamblers back in the day had been doing this shit for decades.
Right.
They could read the smallest intonation, your shift in posture, like your expression before you make eye contact. Like all those things were always there.
Right, exactly.
They just weren't being picked up on.
And that's the idea of face reading and palm reading is not exactly telling the future. It tells you what is more that it tells you the past. And of course you can read what's on someone's hand because you can infer a lot of things by the things they touch. You know what I'm saying?
They've got calluses. They're hardworking. Yeah,
exactly.
They're soft. They're well educated. Like, yeah, there's general things. And yeah, we'll get into it as it relates to Don't Look Now. The stereotype of the like gypsy or
you that's know, not your word.
Roma, and then from my understanding, even Roma is sort of frowned upon these days. I don't have a better word than Roma.
That's better.
Of that tradition. They are, because they are the outsider, we sort of give them the benefit of the doubt. And in Don't Look Now, the mystic in that case is blind. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't that, like it would be, you know, maybe someone with like a disfigurement of some sort or something that makes them the strange, the outside.
Right.
And all of a sudden, like you're suspending disbelief because, you know, that person's experience is dramatically different than your own. Maybe they know something.
Exactly.
Maybe they know something you don't. So with these stories that focus on loss and the want to communicate with those lost and the beyond, we're going to start off with Don't Look Now from 1973. Written by Alan Scott, based on the story by Daphne du Maurier, who also wrote Rebecca and the Birds for Alfred Hitchcock. So it's coming from great lineage, starring Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. Here's a quick synopsis. A married couple grieving the recent death of their young daughter are in Venice when they encounter two elderly sisters, one of whom is a psychic and brings a warning from beyond. Yeah, so that's kind of one of my issues with the story, that it is kind of like this basic singular narrative that doesn't really get too involved. The story is told very well and there are interesting contrasts there, and we'll talk more about Donald Sutherland, Julie Christie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not like the be all end all. You know what I'm saying? But I do enjoy it. I love the cinematography. I love the music.
He sat down, we were in the recording studio, and he couldn't play it like a child. It's too good, Peter.
Well, it's absolutely, it's meant to sound like a child almost learning it because you have the single descending note in the bass line, like, dun, 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 like they're reading it off the music and they haven't seen it before. And that's what's so
brilliant,
heartbreaking about it. It's the storytelling is done, you know, at least 50% by what you're hearing on the soundtrack.
This is composed by Pino Donaggio, who did the music for Carrie. He did the music, not a great movie, but great music, Body Double.
Okay.
It's amazing scoring. Even schlock like Seed of Chucky. Like, this guy is a composer for movies, and that's what you hire him to do. His credits are insane. You could do, we could do a whole episode just on his, like, movies that he's done music for, because he's just any kind of important kind of horror, he's worked on it.
Oh, cool.
You know, he's everywhere. And then he works on TV shows in Italy, too. So, I mean, it's just the guy could do everything. And the music in this is, like, kind of what makes it what it is.
Yeah, yeah. That it is a pretty basic story. It's brought to life in the best possible way.
We start off with Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. They're a married couple. There's a little girl in a red coat in a whole other scene, and we are flashing back and forth between the parents that are looking at photographs of this church and this little girl out in the woods. We don't necessarily know that they honestly have anything to do with each other.
Yeah, there's no connection yet.
Yeah, and you're seeing everything's just very shortly interspersed with each other. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And that theme kind of goes throughout the entire movie, in that we're living in the past and we're living in the present at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And in my notes, I said, this is like The Arrival, because we're seeing flash forward, we're seeing flashback. It's just all happening at once. And I love the way that the little girl, suddenly Donald Sutherland is like brought out of he's studying this picture, and he goes running out to the woods. And that's the first time we know that they're in the same place with the little girl.
Right, right. Yeah, it speaks to the sort of running dynamic of these overlapping worlds,
right,
where we don't know it yet, but it's gonna grow from that point.
Right. And so we see now Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie's daughter has drowned, and Donald Sutherland's the one to find her. And it's dramatic. Donald Sutherland is really good.
He was taking this very seriously.
Some
of the expressions on his face. I mean, this is like Donald Sutherland in my favorite era, where, like, not long after this, he was in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's funny, I have a small note that, like, he's also pretty brave at showing off the bod.
He is, except for that's a wig on his head.
I'm not sure if that's true. I read that in the trivia, and I was thinking, like, it's such a curly mane of hair.
Why would you do that? Why would they? I didn't understand the point.
It feels a little too deliberate to be, like, a literal add-on
put
to his head.
Put that wig on his head.
It's a lot of hair. It's quite a head of hair for a leading man in the 70s, but, I mean, outside of porn. but he wouldn't appear naked again until Animal House.
Oh, good. I'm glad you have that. You should make that part of his trivia.
I think one of the elements I found a little frustrating is the relationship between Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. They're meant to be kind of fractured by the death of their daughter. Once they're in Venice, it doesn't seem like either of them is particularly broken or like walking around with upset. It's only when Julie Christie is triggered by the psychic lady in the bathroom.
She was just having a nice like lunch.
Yeah.
And then goes to the bathroom, and then this lady like accosts her essentially with these feelings.
Oh, yes, she's with you. She's with you, my dear. And she's laughing.
I'm sorry it was dead.
She's wearing a shiny little mask. Christine. Oh, but she's laughing. She's laughing. She's happy as can be.
The words that come out of the mystic's mouth are so, like, par for the course of every generic reading.
Right.
That, like, you know, I've seen my share of the Long Island Medium and, you know, like, John Edwards-style shows where they're relaying messages from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, I mean, the point, I'm sure, is that it's reaffirming. It's
right.
That don't feel guilty. This person still loves you from beyond, and they're happy for you. They're happy when you're happy. So just go on with your life. And, like, that's essentially therapy in a nutshell,
right? Yeah, that's
right?
Nice. That's comforting.
Yeah, that's a closed-ended, like, go on with your life message.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that, and I understand the comfort that brings. And in this case, Julie Christie should have left it the fuck alone.
Yes. Yes,
she should have said, thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be going now.
Julie Christie's like a little bit naggy in this. Like, she's not a very well-rounded lady character.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and
not
like
great.
She does a lot of things that you're just like, ladies, stop. Like,
it's, asking it's, for trouble.
It's like a guy wrote it and it's like, a lady would do this.
Right. I mean, it's the apple all over again. Yeah. It's like, well enough is not good enough.
No, they keep messing with it. Because there's a scene in particular that I love because I also, it's a thing I do that I shouldn't do, but I do. There's a scene where Donald Sutherland is wasted. They went out drinking. Okay. And Julie Christie keeps like poking at him, like keeps nagging. And Donald Sutherland's like, I'm going to go be sick. And she's still like, nag. And he goes and he throws up. And then she keeps fucking at it. And I was watching it and I was like, I totally do that. That's so my style.
I've been the subject of that menacing. Not you. I'm even, not saying you've tortured me. No.
I even wrote like, I like her style. But like watching it on screen, I was like, that's terrible. If I was Donald Sutherland, I would be pissed.
Yeah. Donald Sutherland is kind of thrust into the role of the skeptic. And at that point, like he's got something very specific on his mind. He's in Venice to do a job and he's doing it. It's not the easiest job. It's coming with its own hurdles and life isn't as easy as he would like it. But he's occupied. He's busy. He's not fraught with worry over, you know, over his lost daughter.
Julie Christie should be working with Donald Sutherland. They seem to work together, but instead she's off doing shenanigans all day long.
Yeah, it's a little unclear. Again, like not the best written rule.
Yeah, she just wanders off to go wherever.
To the extent where like you're not really, when she goes back to England to look after their injured son.
Right.
You don't really miss her because she wasn't really crucial to the plot up to that point.
And you're like, oh, I forgot that she was there. And I forgot they had a son because they only ever mention him, but never do you get an idea that they care for that son.
Yeah, once they're in Venice, it really just is about them.
Right.
And I think, I mean, well, I guess we have to get into it because it really is, as it relates to this movie, an elephant in the room. But the long and gratuitous sex scene.
So long. Very long. Lots of sex.
So there are all kinds of rumors, and I think Donald Sutherland specifically spoken to disprove the rumor that they actually had sex. That said, it was such a long scene, and they're very, very naked that like I wouldn't be surprised if sex happened by accident. Because it's just like, whoop, that slipped. Okay, well, that's what happens when you're pressed firmly against one another from the waist down.
It's pretty extreme. It's so extreme. But that scene, just like a lot of them, is intercut with these flash forwards. And I actually kind of... So it was totally long and gratuitous, and it kind of had nothing to do with anything, honestly, at all.
Not really, no.
But what... Just the filming that scene in and of itself with interspersed with the putting back on the clothes. Like I actually thought it was really cool. And the music and everything was so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. The editing in this film is outstanding.
He wanted this film to be subtle in its portrayal of what was going on and to be visually connective from the beginning to the end, so that things that you would not ordinarily pay attention to sometimes or sometimes not prove to be significant later on. For instance, there are many times in the movie where you see the funeral barge. The camera just pans across it, or it goes through the foreground, or it goes through the background. Because you don't know where the movie's going, you may not pay attention to that. So things of that nature are very important in this movie when you see it the second time. And this is one of those movies, I believe, that does warrant a second viewing. I think that there is a comfortable way of editing where people want to be unaware of cuts. And in most movies, that's generally the way you want to go. But in this movie, I deliberately cut an unusual rhythm. I would hold shots when there seemed to be no reason to do so, or I would cut off them too quickly, or I would cut to things that were 180 around and not in the same line. I just wanted to, without making it too obvious, throw people off balance a little bit that way.
And those juxtapositions between the little girl like falling into the water and the parents separate and then together, I really enjoyed, like, there are times where the edits sort of play with contrast, and then there are points where they sort of synergistically connect, and there are like even audio cues that are expressive.
Yeah.
It's a deep flick. I you know, I'm hearing myself talk about it now. Maybe this is the best version of this story as far as like not getting too complicated, knowing that the medium in which it's going to be told is going to get real deep and complicated. But yeah, the first part of the movie feels almost like an art piece.
Yeah, then it goes on and on again, and still goes on. And then you think it's over, but then it goes on some more.
It's just like everything drags.
Like, let's go. Let's pick up the pace a little bit here. I don't know. I felt like, I don't know, when I was watching it though, I really thought of The Arrival, like, so much.
Yeah.
Because I think the idea is that, you know, we're alive and we seemingly live in this like linear thing, but retrospect is not linear. And then thinking about life when it's over cannot be linear either. And so it all kind of goes into itself. And that's kind of like cool, I think. Very cool. Yeah. But then I was like, this is long enough. Like, can I imagine myself at the end of this movie and be done? Is that how that works?
The credits go wherever you need them to go. Yeah. No, it did. The way you're describing it also reminds me, the way Vonnegut would write an alien perspective and as trying to like explain time to a mortal man who lives on a singular plane.
Right.
But the alien is explaining, it's like, no, reality is more of snapshots.
Exactly.
And there are, you know, any number of moments, and then any number of moments that are accessible maybe to them, the aliens, but they're all overlapping.
Ever contact people, can you?
We're often asked. She's quite famous around Elgin.
They all want a lot of mumbo-jumbo about ectoplasm and holding hands. Second sight is a gift from the good Lord who sees all things. And I consider it an impertinence to call his creatures back from rest for our entertainment. Wouldn't be for my entertainment.
By the end of it, I was reminded, and it was one that I saw before this, so I didn't realize it was after, The Haunting of Julia with Mia Farrow. Again, a story that deals with loss and that sort of refusal to accept and, you know, always wanting there to be more. We'll get into it as it relates to The Changeling, but I like a more like whodunit kind of, let's give us a goal, give us a crime to solve.
Sure, I could see that. Yeah, because Changeling does give you that. Haunting of Julia, yeah, just leaves you feeling like bummed the fuck out, you know. And this movie does too.
Yeah,
it's not uplifting. I think the only thing like you can take away with it is like, in 1973, the Italian police were the same as they were during, like, Amanda Knox. Like, they're not going to fucking help you. Don't go there. I think this film goes on for way too freaking long. And in the UK, it was a double feature with The Wicker Man. And I can't imagine what fucking crazy person sits there and watches this movie and then The Wicker Man. Or does The Wicker Man come on first and then this? Like, what happens? And I can't even imagine. It gives me anxiety to think about that evening. I would just die.
I love those two as a double feature. I would hope it ends strong with The Wicker Man because it is a stronger movie, but I know, you're not a fan.
Like, how awful do you feel at the very end of that double feature too?
Yeah, that's kind of a bummer of a double feature.
You know.
I don't really think about it in that sense, but it's not really catering to like leave the theater feeling good. It's like, it's probably going to be a while before you come back for another double feature.
It would be like watching Your Next and then Inside. Like, put the feel good. See you guys.
In doing research for the episode, it seems like seances and cold readings are pretty tightly intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the great clips that I found was Orson Welles on a talk show talking about his love of magic and sleight of hand and close-up magic. And he was actually pretty well known for being really good. And in his early days when, you know, they're away, you know, sort of on location, he spent the whole day doing like a character where he was just like fortune telling and telling people there. And he's doing all the tricks of cold readings. There's a great South Park episode that's worth looking up that deals with cold readings and the like pretty basic mechanics behind it. And, you know, as South Park does, like it obviously comes back around to be this awful thing that sort of flies in their face. But so Orson Welles talked about the experience.
But then there began to happen to me the thing that does happen to fortune tellers, and which is the occupational disease of fraudulence, fortune tellers. And they have a name for it. It's called becoming a shut-eye. And a shut-eye in the argo of these crooks is the fellow who begins to believe himself. You see, and you make these wild guesses. One of them explained to me, he says, supposing you're a night clerk in a hotel, And when you get the job, first of all, a fella comes in, wants a single room. You look at how good his luggage is, how good are his shoes, and you tell him there's a room in the court, there's no room, or yes, sir, depending on various pieces of evidence. Says, you've been a night clerk long enough, you glance and you tell him. You've been a night clerk a little longer and you don't have to look. You've seen it, but you have, the computer in here has made all of those deductions without your being conscious of it. So the mind reader gets so that he, without thinking, does that, and then they say it's true. And a woman came in to me at the end of my career as a fraudulent fortune teller in a bright print dress, sat down, looking perfectly all right, and I said, you've lost your husband last week. And she burst into tears. She had. And then I quit.
That was terrible.
Yes, it's one of those things. Undoubtedly, it's not psychic. Undoubtedly, there was evidence of a tragedy. There was all kinds of things that went into the computer and got processed without me crookedly thinking what I'm going to say to her. And that's how it works, I think.
And even Penn Jillette has explained that they would do shows where they explain up front what they're going to do, cold readings, and then they do it to an entire crowd. And then on the way out, there inevitably would be people who, again, like get close up with an earshot and say, like, I know your magic. Like,
yeah.
I know you're special
and
you're doing something
more. No, I freaking
more.
Told you. I'm just going to make a vague statement and you're going to speak
yeah,
up.
Yeah, we're going to go from broad to accurate based on your inflections.
Exactly. I am reading your face.
But Orson Welles got into the idea of the people who believe their own hype.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that kind of lends into the origins of the spiritualist movement and these public readings as it relates to the Fox sisters.
Yeah. So the Fox sisters come about in American history at a really crazy time. And when we do the episode on spiritualism, I can give you a better explanation, more well-rounded of how America became so infatuated with this idea of spiritualism.
I wouldn't have guessed it was the Protestants of all people.
Yeah, you know, Calvinism became just not cool with all these new inventions.
It's like, too much work.
Yeah, no one was into that. And so materialism and the industrial-like complex and materialism is what leads us into the spiritualist movement. And it does have to do with America's Second Great Awakening, which then we saw Shakers and we saw the Mormons come in the early 1800s. And this all leads way for the 1840s, 1830s is when spiritualism really starts to take hold and people actually give a name to it.
Mm.
We're introduced to the Fox sisters up in upstate New York, in Arcadia, New York. They're just playing a trick on their mom. The whole thing starts 1848. They are playing a trick. It is the winter. It sucks there. And they're like, Mom, come and check this out. This ghost is talking to me. And they're talking through taps because the telegraph was this new freaking cool thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so ghosts at that time didn't talk through talking in 1848. They just telegraphed everything, which if they died before the telegraph, how are they knowing the telegraph? Like, I don't understand how telegraphs work exactly.
Well, it wasn't like Morse code, but it was more like, you know, tap three times for this.
Right.
There's a very good episode of The Dollop, which goes really deep into the culture of the seances and mysticism. And
mm-hmm.
they talk about the number of tapping. In this case, they were doing something as basic as like tying an apple to a string and dragging it like out, like they were out of sight, seemingly upstairs as far as mom was concerned, and then there's a tapping on the stairs.
They were early Foley artists because the apples were meant to be like footsteps on the stairs.
Ah, right, yeah.
That's what they can. And so like they were really creative. But there was always this popping. And so the mom gets really like, I mean, she's like crazy with this and she's like, look at this. And they didn't have the heart to tell her that they were joking. Or else maybe they would have gotten in big shit in trouble. You know how as child stories go and you're like, now I can't, no going backsies.
It only escalates.
Yeah, and so the mom starts inviting neighbors over. And what the girls are doing, the tapping is all coming from their toes. When it's all exposed in 1888, 40 years later, essentially they're like snapping their fingers, but it's their toes.
Yeah.
And they could do it when they were standing. They learned to do it in stocking feet.
Yeah.
They could do it all the time. And they actually had convinced the neighbor that there was a body in the basement, and they were going to excavate the basement. And thank God it rained for like a week, or they would have excavated the basement.
And I think eventually there were digs, and they kind of found like chicken bones and scraps, which they, I mean, not a lot of questioning was happening in these days.
Right.
There were even people who studied the Fox sisters' performances, like looking under the table and like, I don't see anything.
Yeah.
It's like the degree of scrutiny was pretty mild. And I'll talk about it a little bit later as it relates to the Ouija board, where I kind of think of it as like, that's where spiritualism jumped the shark.
Right.
But in this case, like, yeah, the analysis that was done to confirm or dispel what they were doing was pretty shoddy. Like, this is, you know, all these days, the science is in quotes.
And I'll tell you, these girls came about so quickly that they first started this stunt in like January of 1848. And the big final brouhaha was in 1849, when people were doing all the, like, they had sold out the town hall three nights in a row, and people were yelling at them. They had to have the police come in because there was tar set up in the stairwell to fall on people.
Oh, God.
It became a huge thing because it blew up kind of overnight, these girls, and then everyone else started doing it.
Yeah.
And since spiritualism in America was so, everyone just wanted to be involved because it also has ties with being a humanitarian and thinking about more than just yourself.
Yeah.
So the police had to be there. They sell out, and that's when they start doing all the tests. Every night they're like looking under the tables. They had women go in and strip search the girls to make sure that they didn't have stuff. Yeah. And it also, spiritualism comes about when you have really early women's rights at this point in time, 1840s, 1850s, and spiritualism is made up mostly of women. And the people who are conducting seances, things like that, are women. For the most part in America. And so the clergy got real pissed. And then it becomes kind of a misogyny kind of thing of like, lady, they can't tell you. I'm the guy who tells you the things. I'm the guy. I'm the priest, not those ladies.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a finger pointing thing. We find out, though, in like 1888, one of the sisters, she admits like they were just pulling this like out of their ass every single night.
Stunts, yeah.
Yeah, and the year later after that, she recants. The problem is that, so it was two younger sisters. One is 15 at the time, one's 11, and they're playing this trick. As they grow older, which they still are doing these seances clear to the end of their life, they're terrible alcoholics, terrible fall-down drunks. One of them dies essentially from late stages of alcoholism.
Yeah.
And what put them in that position was the oldest sister. The oldest sister never did the readings. She was the businesswoman of the family.
Mm.
And she was the one who knew that she could make money off of this lie. And she was the one who kept them in line essentially for their whole career.
Yeah. It's pretty strange to think that like there's still, it's small, but there's still an entire industry around like this idea.
Yeah.
They've gone from like snapping their fingers to having a producer whisper in their ear details about the audience. But it's still like, it's a lot of hokum. It's a performance. And I think that's kind of how they get away with like the fraud these days, is like they kind of talk about it as a performance rather than like an actual, I don't know, radio with the other side.
Absolutely. But people, I think, wanted to believe so much at that time. They were willing to just go for anything. And especially because, at this point in time in urban environments, one in three kids wouldn't make it past 1 year old. So everyone knew somebody who had died.
Yeah. You know, it came later, but the Civil War and the low average life expectancy meant that everybody was going to come into contact with like some pretty profound tragedy in their lifetime.
Right.
So everybody's got someone waiting for them on the other side. And at the same time, like culture is ramping up and like we discover the germ, this idea that we can be affected by something that we are not seeing. And up to this point, like if you were, you know, a Calvinist, if you were a religious person, then it was work and faith. And if anything you didn't know could be explained by God's will.
Right.
And then we introduce this idea. It's like, well, there's actually more. And so it speaks to the idea that like your average solicitor or fan of these seances, these spiritualist acts, were people with education,
mm-hmm.
people who had, you know, at least in the like very, you know, early starts of education, like learn to ask questions and,
yeah.
and, you know, wonder what else there is. And so at a time where science, you know, the Second Great Awakening is telling people that like there's more to learn than just like work and God.
Right.
And it's a fascinating era in time where it's this sort of gap period where man stepped in and said, I've got the answers. Like I'm a channel. I'm a medium. You can speak to the other side through me.
Right.
And like, why not? What have you got to lose?
Exactly. Exactly. There's this opera and I wanted to tell you about it because I think you would love it. And I'll tell you the whole thing because in opera, we don't spoil the ending. Most of them are like 200 years old anyway. We know how it's going to end. This one's a modern one. It's from the early 1900s. It's by Giancarlo Menotti. And it's called The Medium. And I highly recommend anyone to check it out. It's an operetta, so it's maybe 60 minutes worth of music.
Okay.
And it's about a medium. And her name is Baba. And she is a raging alcoholic. She has a daughter who is her most beloved treasure, but she's terrible to the daughter. She's terrible to everyone she meets. And she holds these seances every night and has people come in and they pay her. And that's how she makes her money. She grifts. And the daughter has to like bang on pans. The daughter has to do all the ghost things and sing the ghost kind of stuff,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
There's also a boy who lives with them who Baba treats like real shit. And he is mute. And I believe he's deaf as well. And so he is like a slave essentially for Baba. And the daughter falls in love with him, Toby. And at the end of the play, after Baba is by herself and she's kind of reflecting on how she's taking advantage of all these people, Toby is in the other room making noise, but she doesn't know because she's so blind drunk and upset from the latest seance that she had. She thinks it's a ghost haunting her.
Oh, boy.
And so it's where you start to buy into your own shtick, right? So she thinks this ghost is haunting her. And Toby's making all this noise in the audience. We all know, like, oh, no, that's Toby, but leave him alone. He can't hear you yelling at him. And he can't tell you that it's him.
Right, right.
And he's in the closet. And what ends up happening is Baba gets the gun out. And she thinks it's a ghost. And she just starts firing wildly. And she kills Toby. And that's how it ends. The closet door opens. And it's Toby.
Oh.
And it's like this crazy, like, dark opera about, like, taking advantage of people via seance.
Wow.
It's really good.
Wow. And the early 1900s, no less. I guess that it's sort of the tail end of like the most popular era of spiritualism. But yeah, that's pretty cool. That
yeah, it was a radio opera.
Ah, okay.
You
know?
And cool. So like you would listen to this on the radio and I'm sure originally you would have been like, you know, someone narrates it when you hear the radio opera like that.
Okay.
But like, that would have blown your mind.
Was it in English?
Yeah, it's in English.
Oh, cool.
It's an excellent show to check out. It's like really great horror opera. In keeping with this theme of like don't look now and seances, we have 1980s The Changeling, which is actually really fucking scary.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked it too. Yeah. There were moments where
I watched it by myself.
Yeah.
And I was really scared. Directed by Peter Medak, written by Russell Hunter and William Gray, who William Gray had worked on Prom Night.
Yeah.
And that short-lived, but I loved it anyway, FX series.
Oh, okay. I have here he also, well, I think it was just like one episode of Dark Shadows, but
yes.
He contributed there.
The 1990 Dark Shadows, let's be sure.
Oh, not your original.
Yeah,
beloved.
I mean, I'll take any Dark Shadows, but let's be clear, it is the 1990s Dark Shadows. Starring George C. Scott as John and his wife at the time, Trish Vandeveer, as Claire.
Yeah. Parents to Campbell Scott, the writer, actor, director. I think the movie would have worked with anybody. It's a tight enough story, but George C. Scott grounds this story mm-hmm. incredibly well, where like he always, as a character, always seems like a little annoyed.
Well, that's very good. We're still not together on the offbeats. And, darling, you're retarding a little too much on the last four bars. Otherwise, it was splendid.
He's a little annoyed, and he's like an old cat. If I would describe him in any way, everything kind of irritates him.
Yeah.
But nothing makes him go too fast. You know, everything is just like, that's whatever. Really funny.
Yeah. So in addition to Patton and his classic role in Dr. Strangelove, he is in a couple great genre movies, including William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist III, Legion, which is like, you know, unrelated to the other films with the exception of like one character. But like, again, these stories where the surly middle-aged guy just lends credibility to this outrageous story. It works.
Yeah. Everything is the pacing that George C. Scott, like the reserved way that he goes about acting is so like cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though, I mean, this movie is very like audio driven and, you know, even he as a composer in the story, he's always like he's reacting to noises, but he's not jumpy.
Right.
And like you were saying, like he's slow to act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I like it because it's so like languid, you know, like just like blah, like ooze. I just loved it. And like compared to like Trish Van Devere, who's very like peppy. It's kind of like what had their house like? How was their house like on a daily basis? She's probably just like flying all around and he's just like, okay. He's like an Eeyore.
Yeah. While the story is based on Russell Hunter's experience, that house is no longer standing and they couldn't find a proper Victorian Gothic mansion. So they built a facade and attached it to the front of a much more modern dwelling in Vancouver. I guess the movie was made. It seems like it was made over a pretty long period of time in a number of different cities.
Yeah.
And then, like, held back for release. Yeah, after all that, like, you kind of expect it to be a far more choppy movie.
George C. Scott's daughter and wife are killed in this, like, really horrific car accident. Like, it's gruesome shit.
Yeah, it's
there's a little bit of bad continuity there, too, by the way, but it's okay.
It's kind of like unnecessarily complicated as far as car accidents go.
Yeah.
And for him to be witness to the whole thing has got to lend like a next level of, is this really happening? Because that was a perfect storm of awful.
Of awfulness. Yeah. So he moves then from New York all the way across the country to Seattle via Canada. In this movie, same as Don't Look Now, what was the deal with little kids playing with red and white striped ball? Like, a red
specific,
and white striped ball is apparently the thing that children love to play with.
Did they not make different colored balls up into the 80s? I don't know.
Only that color.
I don't know. And in this case, I thought it was almost maybe a cricket ball that comes down the stairs.
Oh, because it looks like a one of those, like a croquet thing, but it doesn't. It bounces. It's rubber.
Yeah, but it's not like a bouncy ball.
No.
It lends to one of like the all-time greatest scares. Actually, anything related to these stairs in the movie made my hair stand on end.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's so iconic. When that ball comes down the stairs, it is so iconic and you see it in so many films.
Yeah, yeah. If anything, yeah, this movie is definitely the like cornerstone influence of any number of like haunting stories.
Yeah,
and
it is the
ghost
ring.
Ghost stories.
Absolutely the ring.
Yeah.
And you, like as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, there's the ring. Oh, well, there's this. There's that. And it's just like the ring needs to be like really honest and say, this is what it came from.
Yeah. And the movie The Others as well. Alexandro Amenábar. Amenábar? The director of The Others has talked about this movie in particular being the most influential. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's great to kind of just keep a mental list of like, oh, they use that in this movie. They use this piece in that other movie. And like they've really hacked up this movie to make dozens of others that, yeah, kind of owe the credit here.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. This is 1980. Don't Look Now was 1973, but let's think about The Exorcist. When the doctors say, do you know a priest in The Exorcist? And she's like, what? That's crazy. You're crazy, crazy, crazy. And in both Don't Look Now and The Changeling, they're so quick to be like, yeah, bring the seance people in. You know, let's try that out. They're just so like opposite world kind of a thing.
What do I do now? I mean,
I tell you, off the record, we have coming here many mediums and spiritualists and so, and we test them. Now, 99% utter frauds, but the 1% astonishing.
A medium.
Mm-hmm.
It probably speaks to like the resurgence of that culture. Like these are, I don't know the exact timeline, but people like Sylvia Brown starting to come to prominence, mm-hmm. James Von Prague, like they were like on the Tonight Show doing segments. Yeah. Like it was popular culture by 1980.
Yeah. So I think it's funny. He just like, come on in and we're treated to a husband and wife duo.
Yeah. Who reminds you of anybody?
Yeah, exactly. Definitely Ed and Lorraine Warren. This is like a definite Amityville kind of feeling. And they have the big reel to reel, which also gives us, oh my God, what a great moment when George C. Scott listens back to that tape.
Are you the child killed by the coal cart?
No.
We are here to help you. What is your name?
Joseph.
What is your name?
Joseph.
What is your name?
He was doing EVP. He didn't even know.
He didn't even know, but I was scared to death. I was like, how is this happening? I was watching this by myself. I will never watch this movie by myself again.
Wow. Wow.
I was taking a lot of cold medicine. And I was really upset. It was me and the dog.
It helps Mindy commune with the other side. Robo-tripping.
Give me enough NyQuil and I will believe anything.
I see the dead.
Murphy's like, sure you do.
The dead is cherry flavored. When seemingly Lorraine Warren is doing like automatic writing in the process, I thought that was a nice touch as far as like changing up the typical dynamics of like everybody hold hands and I'll just say mm-hmm. what they're telling me. In this case, like she is wildly scribbling as if right. like she, you know, the spirit has taken her. She's got the Holy Ghost. And
which is a
thing. I thought
she
was sketching.
It's a thing that actually has to go back to Freud of this just writing.
Automatic writing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I loved that. Oh my God, I loved when she did that. But then she starts writing on the table. Bitch, like,
rude.
Stay on the table. Stay on your paper.
Holy Ghost doesn't draw within the lines. Yeah, I thought it was sketching, and then when they're looking at the pages and sort of figuring out words, yeah. I like that as like a very early version of like the ghost chasing shows now, where they're like, "Did you see that fleck of light? That blurry something in the frame? That was a ghost." It's like, you're seeing what you want to see.
Exactly,
like you're reading into this.
I never see it on those shows. When they're like, "This is undeniable," and I'm like, "But I don't see it.
Like,
I want to.
I don't mean to deny, but I don't see it."
Music in this, because George C. Scott plays a composer with like a residency at a university, and the music is by Rick Wilkins, which I thought was really funny because if I hear that name, Rick Wilkins, I'm reminded of Mayor Richard Wilkins from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, okay.
But he has nothing to do with that.
No, but it might have been named after.
Yeah, I don't know. It just reminded me of it. I was like, oh, that's neat. A lot of what we hear though is Mozart.
Okay.
A lot of that piano music is Mozart. And so it's like when George C. Scott, you know, thinks he wrote this song, but it's really an old song. It's like, yeah, fucking, that was Mozart. You didn't write that.
But I do
like
love
Coldplay
those.
Over here.
Borrowing liberally. When he finds the music box and is playing back something that he's already recorded,
right.
he's written and recorded, and that it, I guess they, I'm trying to remember if they know the original source, they sort of figure out that like if it's on a music box, it must have been a very popular piece of music, but you know, it's unlikely that
I wrote it for the first time ever.
Yeah, I don't know. I like those moments in the same way that like I'm with you as far as like wanting to believe. I like those moments where, you know, if there is something in the greater ether and we're just sort of occasionally tapping into that, like, I like that idea. Like, I it wouldn't take that much convincing to get me on board.
Would you ever go to a psychic? Have you ever been?
I've never been to a psychic. I've been witness for, like, palm readings. No. I've done the Ouija board, but even then, like, my dumb friends convinced even dumber me to close my eyes when we did it, and they would just read the letters aloud. That was stupid. I'll talk more about that in the next episode. But
I don't know. I've never been to one, to a psychic or anything. I think I would go. I mean, I'm always interested in, like, how they're doing it, you know, because I don't assume that it's real or anything like that. But, like, I'd go see.
You didn't have, like, a clairvoyant aunt or, like, sister-in-law? It seems like mediums, like, people, I don't know, I'm thinking of a Stir of Echoes where, like, again, it's like a party trick.
Yeah, I mean, well, we do, you know, yeah, because we had tarot in my house.
Oh, you did?
And, yeah, and so, like, also, we do, trying to, like, make this not sound crazy. It's hard. But yeah, card reading, which is not tarot, but like actual with the deck of cards. Yeah, I grew up with that kind of thing.
Okay,
yeah.
Who's doing it in that scenario? Is it your mom?
Well, my mom and my aunt were like into just the tarot, just for fun, like see what would happen kind of a thing. And then the card reading came from like old books of my grandma's.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess before there were tarot cards, you just kind of use what you had.
That's
on
why,
hand.
Like, if someone breaks out the tarot, you kind of like can side eye them because it's really not like the thing. If they break out a real deck of cards, you might think maybe you're onto something.
Oh, that's funny. Because I don't like associate anything really with a deck of cards outside of like magic tricks and poker. I would actually be more skeptical if someone is just like, I'll do it with a deck of cards. I don't care.
Coil. There we go.
Grow up in New York and there's always noise. I lived in an apartment where, and it's funny as it relates to like the Fox sisters and tapping or banging, I lived in this like crap hole of a place. I used to refer to it as like the Fight Club house because we had to like wire all kinds of different things outside so as not to trip the breaker. It was a disaster, this place. When the radiator would turn on, it would bang.
Yes. Radiators in New York took me a really hard time to get used to.
And the radiator, it was just the shape of the room was like very close to my bed. So the first time this happened, I think I moved in into the summer. So it was like a waiting surprise. Right. So when the radiator eventually did turn on and it sounds like someone angrily banging on the pipes next door or below your room, you're convinced like this is man-made, like something's going on.
Right.
And so dumb me, I'm trying to communicate through Morse code back. And so I'm banging on my pipes like, let me know if you need help.
And your neighbors are probably like, what the fuck? Those radiators are really acting up.
Starting a drum circle in their own room with a radiator. So eventually you look it up and you find out that like, yes, expanding pipes and it causes like jutting and banging sounds. But yeah, I don't know if you don't know better, you think it might be coming from somewhere else entirely.
Why does it go on for about a half a minute and then stop dead? It doesn't make sense.
A furnace is like anything else, Mr. Russell. It's got habits. It's an old house. It makes noises.
So I mentioned the stories based on the paranormal events that Russell Hunter experienced while living in an old home in Cheeseman Park in the late 60s. Hunter had worked as a musical arranger, like you mentioned, in New York City, but moved to Colorado in the mid-60s to help his parents manage the Three Birches Lodge in Boulder. In the 1960s, he rented a home at 1739 East 13th Avenue, where Hunter claimed that beginning in February of 1969, he started experiencing strange phenomenon in the house. First, there was the, quote, unbelievable banging and crashing. Again, like...
It's the pipes, dude.
That happened every morning at 6. That seems like when a radiator would turn back on.
Yeah, like, that's when the super woke up and lit the pilot light.
Shortly thereafter, Hunter and an architect friend uncovered a hidden staircase in the back of a closet. The stairway led to the third floor of the home where Hunter found a child's trunk containing, quote, a 9-year-old school books and journal from a century ago. The journal detailed the life of a disabled boy who was kept in isolation. The boy wrote about his favorite toy, a red rubber ball. Everything was a red rubber ball. It was the only toy that they had. It was that and like Lincoln Logs. A few nights after discovering the trunk, a red rubber ball dropped from the top of a spiral staircase in the home.
Listen, if that really happened, I would have been scared out of my fucking mind.
I think that's a fair reaction. Yeah.
Because I would believe if I found this stuff, I would think for sure it is. I'd be like, yes, it was. And it was ghosts and this and that. Because that would scare me to death.
Yeah. So where the movie gets his name from comes from the later seances that he had held in the home, where they revealed the story of a sickly child who was the heir to a fortune from his maternal grandfather. When the child became gravely ill, his parents worried that the boy's inheritance would pass to a different branch of the family. When their son died, the couple secretly buried him in a field in southeast Denver and adopted a boy from a local orphanage who perfectly resembled their deceased son. They trained him to take on the identity of the deceased boy, hence the film's title, The Changeling, and the boy went on to become well-educated and successful. Now, as spooky as all that sounds, there's not a lick of evidence for any of it.
Yeah, that doesn't make...
No, but it is...
It's a great story. I'll tell you, the story for this 1980, The Changeling, is a really tight ghost story.
I really liked it. And more so than Don't Look Now, like, give me a mission. Like, give me something to discover, give me a crime to solve, and I'm that much more excited. Yeah. And I think it makes the story more dynamic. And yeah, in this case, yeah, it works.
It's a great mystery because there's a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah.
And some things that you think are happening that aren't exactly the way that they seem.
You've suffered a cruel loss, John Russell. You've lost a wife and child. The presence in this house is reaching out to you through that loss. The presence is very strong.
They have to go to freaking archives, which I love anytime they have to go to
microfiche.
Yeah, I love that. That gives it like an air of legitimacy.
Yeah. It's funny these days, just the accessibility of the internet makes me appreciate, like, the moment they break out the microfiche in any movie, I'm just like, you are doing the due diligence. Good on you. Like, yeah, that is the legit real work.
Yeah.
If I have any complaints, it's that some of the like ghostly sounds, it can be a little heavy-handed down the line. But overall, like this holds up incredibly well.
I thought they were really scary.
Yeah.
When he's talking. Cough medicine. That's true. When the boy is talking, oh my God, I got so scared.
Yeah, I listened to a lot of this on headphones. They were doing construction near my house, so I was just kind of like really in tune with the screen in front of me. And yeah, there were a number, like I said, anything to do with the staircase gave me the chills.
Yeah.
So that'll wrap it up for this episode. We're going to be splitting this into two parts in terms of spiritualism and seances. We focus on these sort of seance-heavy stories here, and it goes so much deeper, and for that, I'm excited to get into spiritualism.
I'm excited to revisit one of my favorite movies that you used to crap on, and now I think you have a change of heart.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you exactly why, but we're talking specifically about Red Lights, and I will, as a sort of non-sequitur side note, I'll be talking about The Amazing Randy and the sort of practice that started with Houdini as far as debunking. Right. Because yeah, these stories go deep and varied. But yeah, so that'll close us out. We are on all the social media. We are at Rants Macabre on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Drop us a line at therantsmacabre@gmail.com. And iTunes or Stitcher, drop us a review. It'll help us out a lot.
You can also check us out and become a patron of ours on Patreon. We are at patreon.com/rantsmacabre. We have tons of material. We do 2 Patreon-exclusive things a month. So we have a ton of backlogs, killer cars, things like that.
At a bargain of $1 a month, you get to join the party.
You can also donate on our website, therantsmacabre.com, where you can get a merch pack if you'd like.
Yeah, we've got stickers and buttons and magnets waiting for you. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rants Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated.